Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been a comrade in arms, I'm happy to say, for me and countless other Americans, and for that matter, people in his native nation of the United Kingdom. Fighting for freedom in this war for the free world, not in the kinetic sense, but in every other, is our first guest. He is a member of the British Parliament by the name of Owen Paterson. He represents the people of North Shropshire in the British Parliament. He formerly has served in a number of capacities, including as the British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and also as the Secretary of State for Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs. We're catching up with him in the aftermath of an important presentation he made to the Heritage Foundation about Brexit, the effort to extricate Britain from the crushing grip of the European Union. And Owen Paterson is one of the leaders in the fight to get that done and get it done on terms that will be good for Britain as well as, it happens, good for America. Owen Paterson, my friend, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Hello, Frank. It's a great honor and pleasure to talk to you and to your listeners.
Well, truly, the honor and pleasure is ours, especially because you're talking about a topic that most of us, I suspect, on this side of the pond at least, aren't paying the kind of attention to that we should. And I fear that may be true of our elected representatives as well. And I'd like you to set the stage for us a little bit, because some of us may even have forgotten what the vote about Brexit was in the first place. So give us a bit of the background, if you would, and then we'll talk about what's going on at the moment and what needs to be done.
Well, the history is a succession of democratic votes getting us to where we are now. So David Cameron, at the end of the coalition, said very clearly, if you vote Conservative in the 2015 general election, I will give you a vote in a referendum which is absolutely binding. No ifs, buts. You, the British people, will decide whether the United Kingdom should stay inside the European Union. Well, he got his majority and he delivered that. There was a bill in Parliament and it made absolutely clear that Parliament was using its sovereign authority to give the final decision to the British people. And there was never going to be a second referendum. It was a one-off chance and it was up to the British people to make that decision. And they did, against an extraordinary background of what we've now called Project Fear. The government failed to get any real concessions out of the European Union and then bombarded the British people with propaganda, including spending £9 million sterling of our money on a leaflet telling us that we would be complete idiots to vote to leave. And the media establishment and the business establishment and the legal establishment, and probably if asked, the judicial establishment, all were very strongly in favour of not leaving, in voting remain. And what happened? 17.4 million people voted to leave on the very clear promise that that meant taking back control. But we didn't specify during the referendum exactly how you took back control. But happily, that was specified by Mrs. May in the general election last year, in the Lancaster House speech. She said leave meant leaving the single market, leaving the European Customs Union, and leaving the remit of the European Court of Justice. And in the general election, she actually got the highest number of votes for 25 years. And happily, the Labour Party also promised that they interpreted the referendum result to mean leaving, by leaving the single market, leaving the customs union, and leaving the Court of Justice. And the two main parties therefore got 85% of the votes in the general election. And the one party offering to remain, the Liberal Democrats, they actually saw their votes fall.
In other words, let me just put that in my own words, if I can, Owen Paterson. The Tories, the Conservative Party, of which you are a member, took the proposition to the people of Britain, do you want to withdraw from the European Union in the interests of reestablishing your sovereignty and having, you know, the right of self-governance over matters including foreign policy and trade policy and so on. And the British people, by a strong vote, agreed that they did indeed want to do that, which brought about the end of David Cameron's premiership and the advent of that of the current Prime Minister of Britain, Theresa May, who came to power, as I understand it, promising to carry forward with what David Cameron had promised, namely the complete final extrication. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. There was a very, very clear vote. It was the largest vote in British history on any one subject. It was the largest majority in British history on one subject. And it gave a very, very clear statement. And people who voted Leave have been abused, and people in the establishment have attacked for being sick and ill-informed. They knew exactly what they were voting for. In my patch, in the town where I was born, in Whitchurch, people were coming up to me. I went to the polling stations, and there were six polling stations in one building, so you'd get six for the price of one. And the polling officer, the civil servant in charge, said, we've just never seen anything like this. It's just extraordinary. They have got registered, and they're pouring in, and they don't know how to vote. So these people, many of them, had got registered specifically to vote to leave, and they had to be shown how to go to the polling booth and where to put the cross with the pencil. And people came up to me very clearly saying, Mr. Paterson, you know, good to see you here. You know, had my vote leave badges on, showing what I stood for. Good to see you here. We can get rid of you. We could get rid of you in the election. But it's about them, isn't it? We can't get rid of them.
Eurocrats, as they're called.
There is absolutely no way you can vote in any election in the United Kingdom and influence how the European Commission is put together. You can't influence how it's formed, and you can't get rid of any of them. That's really important.
Yeah, and I remember you telling me at one point that at the heyday of this thing, there was an extraordinarily large number of laws and regulations promulgated by these Eurocrats that were essentially binding on over Britain without any say-so from the British people. Is that right? Or their elected representatives?
Well, it's the nature of our law. I mean, whole areas of human activity now come within the remit of European law. We have handed over the power to make law. That law is made in closed committees where there are no minutes taken, where the ultimate votes are taken by what's called qualified majority. So the larger countries, such as Germany or France or the UK, according to population, have a larger number of votes than the smaller ones. But that means we are permanently, absolutely guaranteed as the UK to be in a minority.
We have to pause for just a second. Our guest is Owen Paterson, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting with a distinguished member of the British Parliament, the House of Commons. He has been a member of it since 1997, some 21 years, including stints at the highest level of his government, representing it in connection with the portfolios for Northern Ireland for a time, and Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs as the Secretary of State in those two departments. He is these days working hard to try to make sure that the will of the British people to extricate themselves and their country from the untender mercies of the Eurocrats, the European Union's unaccountable bureaucratic state, is respected. And Owen, I just wanted to bring our guests and audience up to the moment to talk about what Theresa May is doing as we speak. There's something called the Chequers Plan, and I'd like you to explain what that is and how it seems to be quite considerably at odds with what had been promised first by David Cameron and subsequently by Theresa May herself.
Well, thanks very much for having me back. You're absolutely right. The Chequers Agreement is completely unacceptable. It does not deliver taking back control. It does not mean properly leaving the single market, the customs union, or very important, the European Court of Justice. What it's done, basically, in order to have, under pressure from certain industrial interests who export to the EU, and don't forget, exports to the EU only represent 12% of UK GDP. But in order to keep those going, in theory, on a smooth basis, we will be required under Chequers to accept what's called the Common Rule Book. Well, that's a misnomer. That is the European rule book. But unlike before, where, for instance, when I was doing agriculture, I would go and argue about law before it was formed, and I would have alliances, and I would try and work with like-minded nations and try and mitigate some of the damage, we will be absent. These laws will come straight through. We will have no option but to accept them, and no option and no possibility to amend them. And that is pure, that will be on goods, and that very much includes food and agricultural products. That is absolutely disastrous, because those products are always the ones that really are the grit in the oyster when it comes to trade negotiations. And it's very, very hard to see how the United States could do a trade deal if we are bound by laws and regulations which we cannot influence and which we cannot escape from.
Right. So, Lowen, let me just make sure I'm clear about this. In a way, what you've described, it sounds like a poison pill, we would call it here, that Theresa May is actually proposing a plan under this Chequers Agreement that actually makes things worse, making more attractive the idea of staying in the European Union under the present arrangement. That, of course, isn't what you all voted to do. But what can be done to try to ensure that the will of the British people is respected at this point, both by you and your colleagues in the Parliament, the British people, and for that matter, perhaps the Trump administration?
Luckily, during this process, those MPs that wanted us to remain against the wishes of their own electorate, they insisted there should be, quote, a meaningful vote in Parliament. So this issue of the nature of the final arrangement will come to Parliament. And I will absolutely guaranteed vote against Chequers. It is a complete denial of what the British people voted for. And if it went through, would cause, I mean, really very, very damaging, long-lasting damage to the integrity of the political establishment and our institutions. So there would be massive disillusion with it, which would be extremely damaging long-term. So what I hope is, I estimate there's about 80 of my colleagues in what's called the European Reform Group, which is a group of Conservative MPs that will be pushing for a free trade deal. And also last week, the Labour Party, Labour, who are very disunited, they said they also would vote against Chequers. So much the best thing is we kill off Chequers rapidly, because we know, well, the European Union doesn't like it. There was a meeting of very senior customs officers in Brussels only yesterday, and they think it is completely unworkable in practical terms. So what that means, we can go to actually what the European Union offered back in March, when Donald Tusk offered a free trade deal. It's, we could build on something similar to what Canada has, and that is the optimal solution, that we have a very broad, wide-ranging free trade agreement with the European Union, in which we can trade with them on reciprocal free trade without tariffs.
Yeah. Presumably, what you're being subjected to, though, is a punitive response by the European Union, bureaucrats and big governments and so on, for having the temerity to try to get out of the Union. And therefore, they're not going to give you the sort of deal they've given Canada. Is that right?
Well, they did offer it back in March, and the government was very much mistaken not taking it up. But you're quite right. Up to now, every time there has been a referendum vote in a European country, which has gone against the wishes of the European Union. That country has been told to go away and think again and come up with the right result. That's not going to happen this time. And there are lessons to be learned from the way Britain and the new United States negotiated at the end of the War of Independence. And I did mention that at Heritage. The Jay Treaty of 1794 is an absolute model of forward-looking, sensible, magnanimous treatment of an ending, cauterizing of a divisive war. They both agreed, looking ahead, there was Chief Justice Jay for the United States and the then British Foreign Secretary, who then was called Lord Grenville. They had extraordinary sense and foresight, and they looked ahead. They agreed mutual most favored nation status. They agreed American traders could go to the British West Indies. They agreed disputes on the Canadian border, a number of other things like wartime debts could be settled by what was then the totally unknown solution of arbitration. And lo and behold, what happened? Trade between the United States and the then United Kingdom rapidly picked up. And that's a real model of what should be happening now, not trying to be vindictive and sending a lesson to other member states of the European Union not to be so stupid as to vote to leave.
Right, trying to prevent everybody from heading to the exits, presumably. Let me ask you, Owen Paterson, I think it's a quirk of fate, at the very least, if not the divine providence at work, that you were responsible for sort of the Irish portfolio for your government for a time. And one of the sticking points that the European Union and many of the opponents of Brexit in your country incessantly point to is this idea that a hard border will have to be created between the Republic of Ireland and part of the United Kingdom known as Northern Ireland. Talk about the way ahead as you see it with respect to the present Irish question, as I guess it might be called.
Well, you're quite right. This is one of the justifications for checkers. So one of the excuses is that by having this common rule book, we will not damage the integrity of the single market and the customs union. And what the narrative here says is that the only way to protect that integrity, if there's any change in Britain's status, is to put up what's called a hard border, i.e. infrastructure on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. This is totally incorrect. There is an active border now. There is a tax border. There is a value-added tax border. There is an excise duty border. There is a currency border. And very important, there's a security border. And there is no hard border, which means infrastructure on the border. What there is, there's use of modern technology and modern administrative systems. And if your readers like to go to the European Reform Group website or my website, we published a paper last week explaining very clearly that the problems on the border have been massively exaggerated and they are soluble with existing technologies and existing administrative systems. So if you look at the trade, first of all, it's very small. Only 5% of Northern Ireland sales go south of the border. Only 1.6% of the Republic of Ireland's exports go north of the border. They tend to be very regular shipments of agricultural and food products like Guinness. There are 13,000 border crossings for Guinness. Guinness is owned by an enormous, very respected, very professional multinational. A third of Northern Ireland's milk goes south of the border. It's the same milk from the same cows, in the same trucks, on the same road, on the same route, to the same destination every day. That's totally tailor-made, that sort of trade, for what are called trusted trader schemes, authorized economic operators, as we call them in our country, where a known trusted shipping agent basically has a pass and is trusted to go through customs procedures without being stopped at all.
Okay. Let me just ask you, and finally, in closing, and again, our guest is Owen Paterson, Member of Parliament. If you had a request, I suspect you addressed this in your remarks at Heritage, to Donald Trump at this moment, what would you want him to do to try to ensure that this comes out right for both the United States and Great Britain?
Well, the United States has a great chance to help here because uniquely there's a G7 member, the fifth largest economy in the world, could leave, and we hope will leave, and take back full control of its lawmaking. will take back its full rightful role on world bodies where world rules are made, like the World Trade Organization, or on food production, it's called Codex Alimentarius, and could be pushing for open competition and for use of widespread use of modern technologies. At the moment, we are not present on these bodies. We sit and attend, but all the voting and the amendments and the real action is delivered on our behalf by the European Union, which is not pro-competition, which maintains a customs union with high tariff barriers, which militates against US producers, and which is extraordinarily opposed to modern technology. And there's a real battle here for the future of world trade and competition. And what I would like to see happen is the United States rapidly start working with us on a wide-ranging free trade agreement between the United Kingdom and the United States.
Owen Paterson of the British Parliament, thank you very much for joining us and for your leadership at this critical moment. I hope that you will come back to us with an update soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined by a Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, Dr. J. Michael Waller. He is a PhD who has done extraordinarily impressive work over a long period of time, supporting those in government and also training a new generation of national security practitioners in a variety of institutions, from Boston University to some of the local academic institutions here in Washington, D.C. He is a dear friend of mine and one of the duty experts we have at the center on matters involving Latin America. And I want to commend to you his work in this space and invite him to talk a little bit about a very important, little understood, and potentially quite strategically portentous set of developments involving a country in Central America, Guatemala. Mike Waller, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you, Frank.
So tell us a little bit about Guatemala, Mike, before we get into some of the developments that are so troubling there. Why is it important to the United States? What's happening in Guatemala?
Well, Guatemala is a very small country, but it's been important to us for a long time because it was a bulwark against Soviet expansion up to, through Central America and Mexico. And as such, it's a bulwark against illegal immigration from Central and South America. It's sort of the pipeline for immigration from Central and South America into Mexico, and then Mexico is the fire hose into the United States.
And to the extent that we have a friendly government there, as I understand it, under President Jimmy Morales, I take it that our concerns on these scores, whether it's immigration or narco-trafficking or potentially the use of Guatemala as a conduit for even terrorism into Mexico and up into our country, has been somewhat alleviated. Is that right?
Yes, very much so. President Morales is a great friend of the United States, and he's a solid Christian conservative, and in fact, recently instructed that Guatemala move its embassy to Jerusalem in Israel. So he's just a really, really solid ally of America and of Israel and of President Trump. But unfortunately, America is not reciprocating. We're trying to overthrow him by a judicial coup d'etat, which is taking over the court system, dictating who they should put on their top courts, who are mainly left-wing, Soros-trained radical lawyers, and then have the courts order the president basically to wipe himself out of existence.
This doesn't sound like a sensible policy, and I'm sure it would come as quite shocking to most Americans that we're even engaged in anything like this. Mike, the important persona of this drama that I believe has largely escaped scrutiny is the former U.S. ambassador to Guatemala. Tell us a little bit about him and what he's doing at the moment that is at least as troubling as what he did while on duty in Guatemala.
Well, Todd Robinson, he's a career ambassador, personifies this whole problem. And if you look at it through his eyes, you can see how this whole effort makes perfect sense to destroy somebody like President Morales and Guatemala, for that matter. Guatemala is a very conservative country. The left has never been able to get more than single digits in the votes, so they can never get to power through democratic means. So if they had a Cuban and Soviet-backed communist revolution, that didn't work. They had now, after the end of the demobilization of the guerrillas, who remain communists, they have hammer and sickles and pictures of Che Guevara on their banners. They have now been getting American taxpayer money from the Agency for International Development and the State Department, and through the European Union money and George Soros money, to organize by taking over the legal system and not just litigating their way to power, but pressuring the Guatemalan government to appoint Soros-trained judges to run the two top courts of the country. And Guatemala is a curious case because the top court of the country, the constitutional court, can order the president to do whatever he is told to do. And if he doesn't do it, he can be ousted from office by the court. And so this is precisely what's trying to take place right now. And back to Ambassador Robinson, he's a career ambassador. And like so many in the State Department, about 97 to 99% of official State Department personnel, they're very far to the left. They were that percentage of State Department people who gave money to the campaign in 2016 gave their money to Hillary Clinton. And Robinson came up under Hillary Clinton's wing as she was Secretary of State. And of course, her big issues are promoting abortion, promoting all sorts of extreme social agendas, and being sympathetic toward the Marxists. So he came up, he was a key aide to Hillary Clinton. She gives him the ambassadorial appointment to Guatemala. So now he's a careerist with the rank of ambassador. And he has the whole system wired with the Europeans, with the Soros people, with USAID.
And not least the United Nations, right?
Exactly. How could I forget them? Yes, exactly. And so these UN agencies as well, and they're all tied in. And of course, they have these militant underground networks within themselves, a lot of a gay subculture that's very militant and very hostile to Christians and to conservatives and people who believe in traditional values. So they're pushing their own agendas and their own social agendas by abusing their power. And people don't dare call them out on it. So what Ambassador Robinson was doing, just the same way the left has always accused previous American ambassadors of doing and fighting communism, was using and abusing embassy power to undermine the Guatemalan government. And he would text, and I've talked to some Guatemalan lawmakers who have received these texts. He would text them saying that if you want to have your visa to the United States, you have to vote to confirm this lawyer to the Constitutional Court or the Supreme Court. And he would sit in the Congress gallery and in the lobby during these votes and remind them, just his presence would remind them, it wouldn't even be enough to talk, we'll pull your American visas and we'll pull the visas of your kids who are going to college and your other family members unless you vote the way I want you to vote.
So this is direct interference in the internal affairs of the sovereign government of Guatemala, to say the least. And for the purpose of getting these leftist lawyers on the court, and what has been the effect of doing that, Mike Waller, as we've watched play out in what seems to be a growing crisis for the government of Jimmy Morales?
Well, it's turned Guatemala into a petri dish for how to steal the sovereignty from a small country that's trying to stick by its principles and put it under the control of the UN and a militant international group. So by taking away, by eroding the democratic powers of the Guatemalan people to elect their own leadership, they are giving the UN the right by fiat to criminalize activities by the elected leadership and oust them from power permanently and destroy them as a whole political movement. This is the only way the Marxists can take power in Guatemala, is through this judicial coup d'etat that the State Department continues to be pushing. And even a lot of Republicans have been pushing this program.
Well, and that's because this is dressed up as countering corruption, as I understand it. The charge is that the government of Morales is corrupt. This is would not necessarily distinguish it in the region if it were. But much of this does seem to be trumped up and done for these sort of larger political purposes. And the just walk us through, Mike, how these lawyers who Todd Robinson has engineered onto the Supreme Court of Constitutional Court of Guatemala have been now foisting upon the Morales government, the UN. Apparently, the present fight is over whether one of the emissaries from the United Nations will even be allowed into the country. Again, give us a sense of how this is unfolding and indeed where you think it's likely to go from here.
Well, first, it's being weaponized as a theme throughout the region. We have to acknowledge all those countries south of the border are hopelessly corrupt from one degree to another. So if you're going to go after corruption and impunity, do it equally, provided it's in our national interest to do so. But they're only going after conservatives. They're not going after the communists who are running the government of El Salvador, where the president of El Salvador was involved in the murder of our American State Department personnel and the killings of American Marines and soldiers. Literally, he was the commander who gave that command during the Civil War. Then you have Nicaragua, where the Daniel Ortega has a dynasty there. He's made himself an incredibly wealthy person by murdering his way to the top. He and his henchmen had over 123 of my friends and colleagues and trainees murdered over the years. So you talk about corruption and impunity. The UN and the State Department and the Soros groups, and they're all letting these guys get away with it.
Mike Waller, this is a staggering indictment. And I understand that Todd Robinson did not wind up spending much time in his next posting in Venezuela, but is still very much engaged in shaping American policy towards the region back at the State Department. Is that right? And what role do you see him playing at the moment?
He has the whole State Department wired with his cronies, and they're going around Donald Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo to continue to push their own radical agenda. And of course, their radical agenda is going to result in more instability in the region, more illegal immigration into the United States, and will undermine countries like Guatemala, where President Morales wants to shut off Guatemala's very short border with Mexico as the choke point to stop Central and South American illegal immigration in the United States. All of that's going down the tubes because Mike Pompeo is allowing the Todd Robinsons and the George Soros acolytes of the State Department to have their way in that building.
Well, this smacks of the larger problem of the deep state, or as I'm increasingly thinking of it, as the counter state, undermining, as you say, President Trump's policies. Mike, we'll be following this story closely. We appreciate the work you do on this at the Center for Security Policy and so much more. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz. He'll take us for our weekly tour inside the ring right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Bill Gertz, one of the great investigative reporters, particularly working in the national security arena. He has been a reporter and columnist at the Washington Times for many years. These days, he is the senior editor of another great resource, the Washington Free Beacon. He is the author of seven best-selling books, including most recently, iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We value our visits with him each week as he takes us for a tour inside the ring, the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. Bill, welcome back. So good to have you.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Listen, you've been reporting on so many interesting things, Bill, and I just want to go through a number of them quickly because all of them really command the attention of our audience. Let's start with the report you had this week about President Trump evidently actively considering not remaining within two very dubious arms control agreements, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF Treaty, and the so-called New START Treaty, Barack Obama fashion. What's up with all of that?
Yeah, there was an important Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing this week that looked at Russian arms control, Russian-U.S. arms control, and two senior officials, one from the State Department, one from the Pentagon, were asked repeatedly by senators what's happening with the anticipated extension of the New START Treaty, which is really the big issue right now. The INF Treaty has been violated. The violation has been known. Again, this pits the battle of the arms control proponents against those who favor peace through strength, which is basically the underlying Trump administration policy. And there's a big push to go ahead and try and extend the New START Treaty, which limits Russia and the U.S. to 1,550 deployed warheads on bombers and missiles. And this treaty will expire in February of 2021. So now they're pushing to have an extension. And from the testimony, it was pretty clear that the administration, because of Russia's past violation of the INF and anticipated violations of the New START Treaty, and that is in specifically the February announcement by Russian President Putin that they've got at least three new systems which would be covered under START, and yet Russia has not notified the U.S. About these new systems.
This doesn't come as a great surprise to anyone who has followed your writings over the years, Bill. You've done more than anybody I think of, certainly in the press, to document this systemic abuse of the so-called arms control process by first the Soviets and now the Russians. But it is very heartening that even the State Department is now telegraphing that the president is serious about, you know, reconsidering whether we should remain bound by a treaty that is clearly, if it hasn't already been violated, certainly will be by the Russians. This falls into the general category that we were discussing a moment ago with Michael Waller, who was reporting on subversive behavior in the State Department on Guatemala. And it's heartening to find somebody who may be actually tracking with the president's policies over there. Let me ask you, Bill, you have some 17 years ago now written about the China threat. The subtitle of the book was How the People's Republic Targets America. And it seems, again, much of your reporting in the intervening years has further documented how that's being done. You wrote recently about the fact that the Chinese are actively campaigning against President Trump, among other things, by promoting the book that Bob Woodward has written, very critical book about his presidency. You've reported on their broadcasting out of Mexico. You've, of course, been documenting what they're doing with the Russians as we speak, with these Vostok 18 nuclear scenarios, envisioning attacks on the United States. Just if you would, Bill, and I know you're going to be discussing this at the Superb Defense Forum Foundation shortly, how would you characterize the China threat today relative to what you warned of, as I say, 17 years ago?
Well, I would say the China threat today has morphed into a threat that is of greater scale, of greater sophistication, and of more lethality towards the United States. It's based on communist ideology. Again, this is not a popular theme. Everybody likes to pretend the Chinese are not really communist anymore, but they have a conspiratorial view of the West as a imperialist, capitalist threat to them. And they've been actively working against the United States around the world. At the same time, they've allowed their state companies to trade with us. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. But now what we're seeing is, for years we talked about the rise of China and how we wanted a peaceful rise. Well, it's not a peaceful rise. And now they've risen and they're expanding. They're doing this Belt and Road Initiative, which is kind of the use of economic and financial means to expand their power and their military. I recently interviewed Randy Shriver, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he said that the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, is using this commercial Belt and Road Initiative to seek access to ports around the world and to set up foreign bases. Right now they have one, but they're looking at several others, one in Pakistan, one near Iran, and it's a very troubling situation. I'm hopeful that because of the new policy of the Trump administration, which recognizes for the first time in decades that China is a threat. And, you know, I've been hearing this going back to the 80s, that China is not a threat. It's just a normal power that's rising. And now we've recognized that they are a threat, and the president is taking strong economic measures to deal with it. I'm hopeful that the Pentagon and the intelligence community will also take strong measures against China to be able to prevent a future conflict. Again, the whole concept of peace through strength is if you have lethal power and military forces, it will reduce the risk of some type of miscalculation leading to a major conflict.
Yeah, and I think that distinct possibility has been bred by the fecklessness of the Obama years, simply emboldening the Chinese as well as allowing them to steal a march on us. And Bill, one of the other things that we've been talking about here at Secure Freedom Radio a lot is the extent to which the Chinese have been using economic instruments as well as military buildups and strategic plays, what I think of as kind of payday loans for acquiring real estate in strategic places. The degree to which, you know, the old adage attributed to Lenin, I'm not sure it really was his, but that the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will hang them, seems to have under the Chinese another sort of facet to it, and that is we will finance the sale of the rope with which we will be hung by the Chinese. It's been pointed out that American capital markets are being tapped, and consumers for that matter, to fund things like the South China Sea island buildup and militarization and the building even of their next generation of carriers. Are you seeing signs of any awareness of this part of the problem in the councils of the U.S. government, as well as sort of a more general assessment of the danger that China is posing to us?
Not on that particular subject. What we have seen extensively is the theft of technology, again, which if you look at China's weapon systems, I was looking through a Chinese book from the company Norinco, which is one of their main manufacturers. And all the weapon systems in there look like exactly copied from U.S. weapon systems, including precision-guided bombs and the tail packages of precision-guided bombs. I'm sure they've had massive theft of our technology, and it's been going on for decades. And it was only until the Trump administration did a U.S. Trade Representative report, a so-called 301 report, which really exposed all of this, and they recognize the danger that this poses to the United States. And again, it all comes from the first recognition that this is not a benign power, that the people in Beijing are part of a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship, which is a threat to the United States and the free world.
Yeah, and becoming more so by the day, unfortunately. Bill, there's so much more to talk with you about. I did just want to say in closing, I was thrilled that you were present for the program that we did the other night honoring Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. You did a wonderful write-up on his remarks at the Free Beacon, and I commend it to all of our listeners. It is a very thorough account of the important points that the chairman made about both the corruption within our FBI and the Justice Department, the intelligence community, as well as the China threat, in fact. Bill, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.